Okay, Rich, let me go turn it back to Mel for a second, then I'm going to pick up Rich. Mel, do you remember the approximate number of dollars for that thing, ballpark? Was it $50 or $250, so to speak?
No, now you got me. This is a number of years ago. Most likely it was cheap. Most likely it was a $50 or $60 item. And, you know, this is money. This is 1980 money, 70s money. So you can well imagine that it must have been a fairly reasonable product, Dick, over.
Very good. Now, Rich, I think you said MFJ has a product like that. And so give us an approximate price. And is it rated for 80 through 10 meters and rated for a kilowatt? Let's see what Rich knows about that. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, thank you. N2EO. Yeah, MFJ makes it under the Ameritron name. They own Ameritron. It's a five-position switch, rated for a kilowatt, 80 through 10 meters. I think it's about $120. Not good for VHF. What I'm using here, Dick, is it's got a coax line that goes 2 meters up to 1296. I have one by SSB electronics. It's a two-position, you know, say just a two-position relay. And because it's rated for 5 gigahertz, it's like 300 plus. And
okay, so it looks like it's a good way to go, from what I can tell, Bob. The only slight disadvantage of people not using multiple transmission lines is that and you don't have as much backup, and you can't operate multiple bands at once. The advantage of having multiple transmission lines is that you can transmit on one band, listen on another band, have somebody feedback information to you on another band. Contest operations is a little bit help. When there are transmission lines that are so inexpensive, and I'm talking about CATV hardline now, 3/4 inch cable television hardline, and they call it 070, they call it 750, really 0.75 inches, but they call it 750 cable. You go to your local stockyard for your cable TV company, and they usually have, on these 5,000 foot reels, there's usually 150, 250, 300 feet left on the end of the reel. They're afraid to make another run down the block because they'd have to use a splice, so that a small amount of cable left on the end of the reel goes back to the stockyard and sits there. And so you ask the guy who runs the stockyard, hey, I'm a ham radio operator. What have you got in 750 cable or 875 cable? As you can see, they make 0.875 and 0.750 and 0.50 and so on. The stuff has extremely low loss. It's extremely rugged. It can be directly buried in the ground for 20 years. A little bit of rigmarole as far as putting connectors on the end of it. But they also throw away these stinger connectors. They don't reuse them. So for you to take some of their stinger connectors and refurbish them, clean them up a little bit, put some silicone grease on the rubber gasket inside, use your Swiss Army knife to whittle out the foam at the end of the cable so that you do the installation of the cable connector yourself, as opposed to buying the $50 fancy tool that does that, and that's an extremely good solution. Right now, you're listening to a length of that kind of cable. I've got over 1,000 feet of it in use on my property. So I like multiple transmission lines as opposed to multiple relays on a single transmission line, because I can run crossband, and I like the redundancy. Not everybody thinks about the problem the same way. And what I'm getting at is that 3/4 inch hardline, most amateur radio operators get multiple hundreds of feet of the stuff free of charge. And if you will go to the Andrew catalog and buy a cable of equal value, equal performance, you'll pay $5 a foot, and you can get it for free. And occasionally the guy will charge you a nuisance charge of $10 in order to help you haul it away or whatever. Don't give him any flack on that one. The slight disadvantage is that 75-ohm cable versus 50-ohm cable. You come out way ahead because 75-ohm has lower loss. And even if you did no correcting, and there's simple ways of correcting it, if you did no correcting, you'd end up with a 1.4 standing wave ratio because it's 75-ohms, and 70-ohms instead of 50-ohms. I solved the problem by putting a big piece of tape across the table, across the cable, and I write 50-ohms on the piece of tape. And I make sure that part of the cable faces towards the transmitter, and the transmitter never knows the difference. A little bit of a joke there. KB1OQD, KQRIW on the tech net.
Okay, Dick, all right. And Mel, yeah, I think it was Palmer. Back in the CB days, they were very popular in linears there. So, yeah, probably turn around, it'd probably be the best way to just run the multi-line there. Because I'm going to eventually end up running a line for 10 meter here soon, too. So I guess just multi-lines would probably be a lot easier here. And yeah, you were discussing about that 0.750 cable there. I have a friend of mine that does cable vision out here. And I got to remind him again. I asked him a couple of times before about it, and he never got back to me. But that's something I'd definitely look into and get the stingers. And fortunately, I'll probably be able to get the tool a lot cheaper, if not for nothing. So, all right, that basically answered the question there, and I appreciate it once again there. 73 is everybody there, and I guess I'll pass it on to the next one. KB1 OQD, and Greenwich will be on site.
Very fine. That's Bob from Greenwich. And so pretty soon he's going to have more transmission lines, more antennas. He's going to light up the ether in that portion of Connecticut. Steve said he had a no, and Marvin said he had a no, and Barry said they had a no, but I bet you they don't really have a no. Anybody else want to sign in because you really got a question, or any one of the no's want to change their mind? Give me a call right now, KQRIW.
Hey,
C2MVP.
Yes.
Okay, I heard Steve. Who was the other person?
And 2APG, Dave, and yes.
Okay, Dave, haven't heard from you in a while. All right, Steve, Stein's in first. Let's see what Steve's got to say. You got it, Steve.
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on that. Happy Father's Day to one and all. Dick, the last guy, he got me thinking. I have a couple of those relays here that I would like to use. The only thing that's basically stopping me is putting RF on the coax. So I'm a little weary of that, you know, just the fear that something in there might mess up and put that voltage back into my transmitter. How reliable are these things? And basically, has there ever been a problem with them? I got a couple of these relays, and they also have a couple of preamps that work that way. You know, like I said, I'm just a little bit weary of using these things because I'm always afraid that something's going to mess up in that thing and I'm going to have a fried transmitter. Back to you.
I doubt it highly. The power supply that powers a relay can dish out 12 volts, 15 volts, maybe even 26 volts at a fraction of an ampere. For any reasonable transmitter, I can't believe that's going to give you any grief. However, if you want to be double-dot sure, you make yourself a coupling box, or you buy a well-made one that's commercially made, which has the line coming from the transmitter. The very first thing it hits is a coupling capacitor. The capacitor is chosen to have enough picofarads or microfarads such that it is essentially a short circuit at RF. But because it's a capacitor, obviously it's an open circuit at DC. So as long as the first thing that the cable coming from the transmitter hits when it goes into your, let me call it bias box, it's because it's going to put, I'm going to call it bias voltage onto the transmission line. As long as the first thing it hits is a capacitor, as long as that capacitor doesn't break down, as long as it's made with reasonable quality, no voltage gets coupled back to the transmitter. Then by way of an RF choke in that bias box, your DC voltage is applied to the center conductor of the transmission line. The RF choke, you choose it to have enough nanohenries or microhenries so that it's an open circuit to the RF, but a short circuit to the DC. So a microhenry or something like that would do it very nicely. People have often used 2.5, is it millihenry or microhenry? I think it's millihenry. 2.5 millihenry RF chokes, high wound, for transmitters. And they cover 80 through 10 meters if you buy the right brand name. And they're essentially an open circuit to the RF across that whole frequency range. But the DC flows through with, you know, 1 ohm of resistance, which is going to give you very little voltage drop. So now by way of the RF choke and the power supply feeding it, and the one end of the RF choke goes to the power supply and a switch that turns it on and off. One end of the other end of the RF choke touches the center conductor of the cable. And that composite cable then goes out of the box, and that is the transmission line that goes up the tower. And at the far end, you have another box just like that. you don't need another coupling capacitor depending on what kind of an antenna you've got. Many of our antennas are a open circuit as far as DC is concerned, in which case you don't need another coupling capacitor. What you need is an RF choke on the upper box, at the top of the tower, to pick off the voltage that goes to fire the relays. And so it's not too difficult. When you see it written down as a schematic diagram, and I wish there was a chapter in the Radio Amateur's Handbook that indicates this way of doing it. There may very well be. I guarantee there's a couple of articles that have appeared in Hints and Kinks over the years in QST Magazine on how to do this. And as I said, I did it by flipping relays in order to have my zoom control of my 16 Yagis that were in a great big array, four Yagis wide, four Yagis high, and I used it on 432, a real fun antenna. Used that from, I think it was 1982 to 1986, whenever Hurricane Gloria came along, and ripped it all up the tower for me. But I knew that that particular array of 16 Yagis, which was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, a great big cube of antennas at the top of my room number 6 tower. I knew that because of the size of the tubings I had used everywhere, that the thing had a calculated failure of around 75 miles an hour, which is a 1 per 50 year event on Long Island. 75 miles an hour occurs 1 per 50 years for your particular square fraction of an acre of property. And the Hurricane Gloria event was a 1 per 50 year event. It hit me with something like 105 miles an hour, bent the top of my tower over at about a 30 degree angle, from the 90-foot level to the 100-foot level, the row number 6 bent over at a 30-degree angle, and all of those beautiful Yagis had yanked off the tower and deposited into my front lawn. I went out there and took them apart and salvaged as much as I could. And I didn't cry over it because that's exactly what was supposed to happen. That was the calculated failure for that wind speed. So I don't think you should be afraid of it. By way of an ohmmeter, you can confirm that you've got the open circuit to the DC. By way of all kinds of instrumentation, or just knowing the value in picofarads and being able to calculate capacitive reactants by the formula that's in the handbook, you can know that the RF is going to flow through that coupling capacitor, but the DC will not, and your transmitter will be protected. A final stage of a transmitter that's capable of 100 watts of output is extremely rugged, Steve. You'd have to really hit it with a hammer to do something to damage those transistors with a great big heat sink. So you may be worrying unnecessarily, and even if, at worst case, you did something really terribly wrong and killed the final transistor of your 100-watt solid-state transmitter, when you got a guy like Andy, the VA2CDL, who can repair anything, for you to get it back on the air is no great big deal. Let me talk to you, Steve, and so don't be afraid of it. I like the redundancy of multiple cables. The only reason I didn't use multiple cables is I was feeding one particular antenna array, and I wanted to choose which of those antennas were fed at any one period of time so that I controlled the beam width of the antenna, horizontal and vertical beam width. But when it comes to multiple antennas on multiple frequencies, on multiple locations on the tower, I'm a strong advocate of using multiple cables going to them, so I've got the redundancy, the feedback capability, the cross-banding capability, and so on. In fact, you can tell right now that I'm transmitting out of one antenna from one cable, receiving at the same instant of time, out of another cable from another antenna, and that's how I can hear what's going on. I'm listening to what comes back from the repeater, and so if somebody's words get covered up by some reason while I'm talking, if my words get covered up, I can tell you right away which words I have to repeat. So having multiple cables in my case, as you can tell, turns out to be a very handy thing. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Steve.
All right, Dick, thank you for the explanation. So long as, you know, the failure rate of these things is quite small, I'll have to figure out a use for this thing. I got stuff in the back of my head, so I know I can go ahead and do it. Once again, I thank you for the explanation. Back to you.
Okay, the next person with a valid sign-in, not saying no, but saying yes, was Dave, into APG. Dave's into astronomy, binoculars, ham radio, law enforcement, EMS. He's a real broadband guy. In fact, I've been reading the latest few issues and thinking about you, Dave, when I read Astronomy Magazine or Sky and Telescope Magazine, and they're up to something like 210 exoplanets now. In other words, 210 of those stars out there, or 210 planets, have been found going around those stars. And we're slowly getting better and better instrumentation, so we can see things that are more and more Earth-like in size, and more and more in the Goldilocks region, between not too close to their star, not too far away, where life is capable. And I think the current thinking is something like one star in three has a planetary system. Whereas when Frank Drake wrote his equation where he tries to predict how much life there was in the universe, he used to think one star per million had a planetary system going around it. So however much life Frank Drake predicted in the mid-60s, a million to one versus one in three, you could say that the amount of life up there has just, in our estimation, has just increased by 330,000 to one. So the big QSO is something we can look forward to with a N2APG, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, I got a little comment for that other statement, N2MB.
We'll get to you, Barry, right after Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, Dick. Very good evening, N2APG. Is the signal adequate tonight?
Dead full quality into the machine, and I'm hearing you on the input. Go for it.
It's that high-power walkie-talkie I'm using. I have an antenna question, and I just don't know. Is that something you might be able to help me with?
I dabbled with antennas from time to time. And by the way, I just received on Friday, because I ordered it a couple of months ago, because I saw an advertisement, my favorite book on the subject of antennas is the Antenna Engineering Handbook. It originally was edited in 1961 as a McGraw-Hill book by a guy named Henry Jasek, who used to run the Jasek Antenna Engineering Laboratory. I think it was in Syosset. AIL bought Henry Jasek Laboratory, acquired Henry Jasek. He became a vice president of AIL. I had quite a few interfaces with him, established a real good relationship with him before he became sick and died in roughly 1976. Died much too soon. His book got updated for the second and third edition by R.C. Johnson, and now the fourth edition, I think it's Volakis is the man's name. So there's now a fourth edition printed April or May 2007 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. A little bit pricey. Go to the right website, you can get it for $135, brand new. 1,800 pages of antenna information. 59 chapters on 59 separate sections of the antenna art and science. 80 separate authors of those sections. A whole lot of brand new stuff in that book. So that's one heck of a book. As soon as your good technical library gets a copy of it, if you don't want to spend $135, do get a copy of the fourth edition Antenna Engineering Handbook. I've been going through it over the weekend and saying, wow, I got to build one of those. So go ahead with your antenna question, Dave.
Okay, Dick, here, let me see if I can explain it easily and quickly. I'm trying to assist a public service agency, and I have no pecuniary interest in this or anything like that. They have a radio system that operates on about 454 megahertz, 454 in the UHF band. And basically, they're using an omnidirectional antenna right now, and they're really not able to communicate with some of the portable units, which are in one direction away from, you know, their base unit. And I saw what they were, you know, operating with, and I said, gee, you know, what you need is a Yagi. Point the Yagi in the direction that you want to talk, and that'll improve your situation drastically. So they tell me they basically have no money to spend, et cetera, et cetera. So I replied, well, no problem. We can make an antenna. We can make a UHF Yagi, you know, four, five, six elements. Shouldn't cost more than, you know, a couple of bucks, and it'll help your communications. So, number one, we're probably going to build a couple antennas as an experiment to use on this 454 megahertz frequency. But on eBay now, I noticed they sell a, you know, ready-to-go commercial-grade Yagi, which is rated between 430 and 450 for that band. So my question is basically, using rudimentary testing equipment, I have an inexpensive UHF SWR meter, I have a field strength meter, but that's about it. I don't have a bird watt meter or anything like that. So using some rudimentary equipment, how can I decide, or how can I judge, whether or not this 430 to 450 Yagi would work acceptably well on 454? In other words, you know, where is the cutoff? Where would you say the performance is no longer acceptable on that frequency? Could you give me some guidelines on that?
WB2HWW, please.
And before we get to that, I still got another question for you, Dave, and that is, the Yagi you're thinking of using on 454, which is on 430 to 450, how many elements does it have?
Okay, that Yagi, I believe, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it's a 5-element Yagi. It's either 5 or 7.
Hey, can I get in here for a minute?
Okay, what's the subject matter, Howie?
I wanted to ask him a question. Are they running a duplex system? Is it a repeater? Because some of those antennas may not be DC grounded, and some of the amateur antennas do not duplex well. They make noise. Also, how far are they trying to talk? Let's see if they have a problem with their transmission line. Using a beam may not be the total answer, because then they won't get stuck in an omnidirectional pattern. Are they running it in repeater service, or are they running it as a wireline remote?
And can they get it a lot higher? Yeah, it's a simplex system. You know, they're using, basically it's a beach setup. And the headquarters is down on one end of the beach, and they have portable units going all the way down about 7 or 8 miles down the beach in one direction. That's the unit simplex.
And how many...
What base station antenna do they have?
Well, how high is their base station antenna, and what kind is it, Dave?
Okay, right now they've got what appears to be a fairly old, in need of repair, Ringo Ranger, which is not that terribly high. Maybe it's maybe 20 feet off the ground.
All right, WB2HWW.
Okay.
Please, you want to go to something like a PD201, a 5DB6. You don't need a beam. If you can go to a PD201, you might get them for a couple hundred dollars. You want to go to a 5DB6 and get it up at about 30, 40 feet.
Yeah. The things to be concerned about here is, because it's down a beach X number of miles, hopefully that's almost line of sight. Until you get to 10 miles, you have no real earth curvature, so that's not doing it. Multipath off the beach, off the dunes, that's an aggravating factor. Is the transmission line going to the current antenna? Because it's been on a seashore for lots of years, it's probably had a lot of salt spray. If it's a flexible cable, water vapor and salt spray, water vapor has been slowly migrating through the flexible outer jacket. Any of the so-called foam-filled cables with a flexible outer jacket will slowly migrate water. It takes 4 or 5 years to happen. And if the antenna has been there for that kind of a length of time, they could be getting an awful lot of loss in their cable. So the current antenna with a good piece of cable could be doing the job. Howie is giving you some good suggestions on much better antennas, a little bit of altitude, real good cable going to it. That's a very nice approach. I can see why you want to pursue Yagi, because it's approximately one direction where you're having the problem. Although, maybe you've got to talk both up the beach to the left and down the beach to the right, so to speak. So, you may have another problem there where the Yagi with its front-to-back ratio would be aggravating things. If you combine the Yagi antenna with the Ringo Ranger antenna, you're going to be getting some peculiar effects between the two. I won't get too deep into that one right now. But combining the antennas in order to try to intentionally give a fill-in, you got to be a little bit careful with that one. When it comes to Yagis that are, say, three elements, tuned between 430 and 450, and moving it up to 454, no sweat. When it comes to 5 to 7 elements, it's getting marginal. Yagis tend to have pretty good gain that falls off slowly as you go down in frequency from the design center. When you go up in frequency from the design center, a number of the Yagi designs at some particular critical frequency start falling off like a rock. Now, that's not a showstopper. It's just something to know about ahead of time. Standing wave ratio will not tell you this phenomenon. There are antennas that when you're using off-center frequency, the VISWR is terrible, the gain is fantastic, and vice versa. There are a few antennas that when you go way off frequency, the VISWR ain't so bad, but the gain does terrible things. because of this clip effect on the high end. With a little bit of smart, you could buy the antenna because you like its mechanical construction, and it's nice and rugged and well-built, and then just by moving the frequencies intentionally, by changing the lengths of the elements, you can get it up to the right frequency. So you could retune the antenna. Almost every antenna you and I have ever used, Dave, if you scale it as a function of frequency, the antenna will give you the exact same performance. So if you're trying to move it up 5% in frequency and you shorten all the elements by 5%, you are essentially there. Yes, you're about to say, do I have to change the spacings? The spacings are not as critical as the lengths of the element. So by changing the length, leaving the spacing alone, I think you can get there. So you've got a number of choices here. But before you get too far downrange, I would worry about the quality of that cable. Do they have the ability to raise the antenna? Probably the answer is no, but sure would be nice if you could get some extra altitude. So these are a couple of hints. I know that Barry wants to make a couple of suggestions, too. Let's give him a chance. N2 moves out. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, actually, I had a comment for the other station that was here before. I just want to mention quickly that I believe he's trying to put multiple frequencies from one transmitter into the feed line and look at a couple of antennas. That can be done with relays, but it could also be done with one of these divider devices, which are, they don't have any moving parts, and they're pretty reasonable, and you can get them pretty easily from HRO or those companies. That might solve his problem. You know? The other thing is that this station that we're talking to now, is his signal, how far away are these portable stations that he's trying to work, and is there something blocking them between the receive station and the transmitting station? Is there something in the way that should be considered? And I think the most important thing is what you said was, I think it needs height and probably a new feed line. If this has been by the ocean, I would imagine that the feed line is pretty shot, and the connector probably has water in it, and, you know, rust in it, and salt in it, and everything else. So I think just cleaning it up, putting up an omnidirectional antenna, but getting it high would probably solve this problem.
WB2HWW with a very important comment on this.
Hey, he's trying to get 7 miles into handies, which is pushing it. Unless you're running quite a bit of steam, 7 miles into a handy is pretty far. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, two things. He should check all his handy talking. Typical operation with it being used for, you know, in this type of service, you know, guard service, you don't know what kind of condition the rubber ducts are. You don't know what kind of condition the batteries are. I've dealt with this type of stuff, so you need to get a service monitor and check out the entire system to make sure that all the components are working, Dick.
Yeah, that's a good point. By way of a service monitor, and by way of somebody like Andy at A2CDO, who probably is down to his last two service monitors, you can confirm whether or not each of the handy talkies has half a microvolt or a quarter of a microvolt of sensitivity. A good handy talkie will have a quarter, half a microvolt of sensitivity. A bad one may have 10 microvolts of sensitivity. That sounds like, hey, you think it's close. We're talking about 30 and 40 dB of desensitization here. When you go from a quarter of a microvolt to 1 microvolt, that's 4 to 1 in voltage. That's 13 dB or so in gain difference, sensitivity difference, just to give you that one example. And if you go from that to 10 microvolts, that's another 20 decibels. So you could be 33 decibels down because the handy-talkie responds to 10 microvolts instead of a quarter of a microvolt. And I've seen handies that'll do that. And that can aggravate the daylights out of things. A beach environment, 7 miles along a beach, usually it's pretty flat. Usually, except for some multipath off of the sand dunes, it's not too bad. At 20 feet of altitude, if the antenna's working well and got a good feed line, and you're putting 30 watts into it, should work on the downlink. In other words, station to handy. But now for the handy, which only wants 5 watts to get back to the station, that's a little bit more difficult. So you got a couple of things to check on, Dave. And let's see how it goes. And to Alpha Papa Golf, K2RIW.
K2KEY got a good suggestion for him to talk to us enough.
Go ahead, Mel.
Had a similar situation with a charity situation with no money involved. And I just replaced, I put up one of those quaggy sticks, one of those that you make out of coat hangers. And boy, what a difference that made. And actually, I can say, no cost situation over.
Yeah, I'm a little worried, though, that if all these handy talkies on the beach were always in one direction, then a Yagi-like antenna is a great way to go. But if he's got